Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
Dr. Ben Rolfe is with us in the studio now. Ben, good morning. Welcome to Money FM.
Hi, Glenn. Good morning.
Great to have you with us today. And Ben, there's so many places we could start with COVID-19, especially you've been tracking that. You're, every day you're working hard to make sense of what's going on where. But why don't we start with Europe, since the WHO came out just the last 48 hours or so declaring that the epicenter of the pandemic. What do we know about what's happening across Europe right now?
Well, thanks. It's a good question. And certainly, as a public health specialist, you look at prime ministers and foreign ministers announcing these draconian measures. And even for someone who's worked in this for many years, it's still surprising the extent to what's happening. And I think the first thing is to say Europe is now moving, but they're moving too late. China borders 30 days with the extraordinary response that they mounted, you know, 40,000 new health workers in 6 weeks, 50,000 new beds in 6 weeks. You know, they really mobilized.
Yeah.
And in mobilizing, they bought the world 30 days.
And, of course, closing down Hubei province almost entirely. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the same population as Spain.
Yeah.
You know, they closed down and they took these incredible measures, and Europe had time to get tests out to the community to limit such a social distancing, etc. And they really didn't. And indeed, some countries still are not. But others are doing more. Austria has closed down all shops apart from groceries and pharmacies. Others have done the same. So there is this mobilization. But I think the thing that it's critical to understand is the number of cases that we see today is where we were 10 days ago. Because, of course, people get tested when they get symptoms, and it takes time for those symptoms to develop.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing about Europe, if you compare the other European countries with what happened in Italy, they are all on a similar trajectory. They're all heading in the same direction. The curve, if you like, is about as steep. And so it is very likely that other European countries will be where Italy is today in maybe 2 weeks' time. And that's certainly a concern.
It was my understanding that the number of cases doubles every 6 days. Is that the latest thinking?
That's correct, but it's really important to emphasize that this is not out of our hands. It doubles every 6 days if you do nothing.
If it's unchecked.
That's right. And we've got great examples, for example, here in Singapore, where they've managed to reduce that reproductive rate hugely by, you know, basic interventions.
Yeah, we have just over 200 cases here, I think 212 cases in Singapore now. And look, looking in the rearview mirror is always a fun exercise. But why do you think it is that Europe, you know, refuse to take action sooner? I mean, surely they must have realized that, you know, we're in a global environment. People travel, and obviously diseases and viruses travel too. Why do you think they were so slow? Is it just because it's so painful to take some of these steps, especially the social distancing steps?
I think there's a journey that everyone needs to go on, and SARS brought the Asian health systems to face with what the reality of a pandemic, and they built capacity to respond. You know, if you look at Singapore's response, it's absolutely textbook. They have a brand new shiny National Center for Infectious Disease. You know, they were prepared, and they have been able to reduce the spread with very minimal pain compared with what Europe are going through now. Europe, I don't think, was psychologically or materially prepared, and now, of course, they're going to pay the price for that.
So. Yeah. And again, let's just, for the listeners, this point has been made over and over again. And in fact, I just had a friend yesterday who was reaching out saying, hey, I've got a trip planned to Europe for business. I'm supposed to go to Amsterdam and Germany and et cetera. And, you know, should I go? And I responded, heck no, don't go, because he's not worried. He's young. He's not worried about getting sick. Or even if he does, you know, he was more worried about potentially having to be quarantined when he comes back, right, and miss 14 days. But my point was, it's not about you. It's about who you might pass this to, or the, you know, creating another cell of sickness, you know, if you return to Singapore or wherever you might be overseas. Give us a little bit of your thinking on this as well. The pressure that it could put on healthcare systems, I mean, that's really the big play here, which is one reason why staying healthy is so important.
That's right. I think the first thing is, this is not so much about individual risk.
Right.
You know, there are marathons still going ahead in Europe this weekend, which is absolutely crazy.
Unbelievable, right?
But of course, you've got these young, fit people running marathons. They're not personally at huge risk, because even if they get the disease, and they probably will, because most people will get it eventually, they will likely be fine. It'll be their grandparents and their parents and their co-workers' parents and grandparents that will suffer. and, of course, the broader health system. People who are using the health system routinely, who are turned away because they don't have the capacity to deal with cancer cases or pediatric cases, etc. And I think that's the real take home for me, is the challenge of this outbreak is not so much the mortality. It's the drain on the health systems and what that will do in terms of mortality and well-being, particularly for our older populations.
Yeah. Talking with Dr. Ben Rolfe, who is the CEO of the Communicable Disease Threats Initiative based here in Singapore, but tracking COVID-19 all around the world. Ben, maybe we can talk a little bit more close to home. You know, you have been involved in tracking communicable diseases for quite a number of years through your work, and you've worked especially with malaria and other types of things. What have you learned from some of the other work you've done over the years that is applicable to what we're seeing now?
So the malaria case is a really fascinating one, because in 2012, there was a global mobilization to decide that really it was time to end this disease. It's a dollar test and a dollar treatment. And it's so when you've got such an easy package of interventions, why not roll it out worldwide?
Yeah.
And so the Asia-Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance was set up just after that. And we had a whole bunch of global leaders came together. We raised huge amounts of money. Financing for malaria has tripled since then, and the disease has more than halved. And it shows that when you get a global mobilization around a disease and you get prime ministers and foreign ministers involved, you see results on the ground.
Yeah.
That is now what we need to see with COVID-19. There needs to be an enormous mobilization. And of course, it's happening in Europe, but it's happening too slow.
Yeah, too slow. And of course, you know, never mind what's happened in the U.S., which has been just, you know, just crazy in terms of how slow things. And one of the things I noticed from the most recent updates from the Singapore government, which, of course, we all know, you know, through the WhatsApp app that they've sent out, and it's, you know, fascinating to track the different cases and to see see the different numbers in a very transparent way. But a number of the cases that have come back to Singapore that have tested positive were people that traveled back from the U.S. Never mind, of course, Europe as well, different European countries. But the U.S., from my perspective, is really the sleeping giant in all of this. And of course, we've seen Washington State and a few other places that have really spiked. What are you expecting to see case-wise coming out of the U.S. in coming days and weeks?
Well, the U.S. has a real challenge, because you're right, they moved incredibly slowly. While China were churning out 1.5 million tests per week, as of 2 weeks ago, the U.S. had only tested 1,000 people. So they are moving incredibly slowly. They also, of course, have a very weak healthcare system. They have the most expensive health system in the world, but the least efficient. And so you have 16 million completely uninsured Americans. You have huge barriers to going to get tested, 0 hours contracts, so people can't afford to stay home, people having to pay for tests. So they have a real problem, because they don't have the level of public health infrastructure or the universal health coverage that you need to treat people in a crisis. And if ever there were a lesson that if you don't keep everyone healthy, you put yourself at risk, it is the United States. You know, there will be very well-insured and wealthy people in the U.S. now who will be wishing that they had universal health coverage and you did not have millions and millions of people who are unable to access basic preventative health care.
Yeah, and of course, they've announced an initiative yesterday, I believe it was, with a lot of retailers. Now they're going to start doing the drive-through testing. They've started that already, but of course, they haven't ramped it up to a level that we've seen in Korea, for example, which it's been very successful. I think maybe over 100,000 tests in Korea, some massive number. But still, it's plodding along. I would assume at some point the U.S. will start to catch up, but by then the numbers will have just exploded in this, right?
That's right. And you have to think, why do we test? You know, in Singapore, we test, and then we have teams of contact tracers that will go and identify everybody. The person that tested positive have met in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And they go to extraordinary lengths. You know, they look at CCTV on taxi ranks to find out what taxi these guys took. It's extraordinary. Now, of course, you get to a point where you have so many cases that there are not enough contact tracers to be able to follow them up actively.
Sure.
And so then you do what the UK have done and said, well, actually, we're not going to do community-based testing anymore. We're going to test people in hospitals, but if you have symptoms, stay home, self-isolate, and ride it out unless you get really sick.
Mm.
And I think, in a sense, when it gets to that point, you've lost the initiative, and that's certainly where the UK is heading, for example, at the moment.
There was an interesting thing that came out from the UK, this idea, I think Boris Johnson said it, and I could be wrong, so take that with a grain of salt, but it's better, something to the effect of, it's better for people to get the virus so that they'll build up immunity to it. And I've read conflicting follow-ups to that. Some say that's absolutely wrong in this case, and others are like, "Oh yeah, that kind of makes sense." Kind of like measles, right? What is the best thinking on that right now?
Well, I think firstly we have to accept that the majority of the world's population will get this at some point. We have no existing immunity, and so if we learn from previous pandemics, 1918 Spanish flu, 30% of the U.S. population got it. We can assume about 30% of the world. Swine flu, about 40% of the U.S. population got it. We can assume that's the same for the rest of the world. Now, Harvard epidemiologists are saying between 20 and 60% of the global population will be infected this year. Mm. It sounds reasonable.
I saw a 70% number as well.
Indeed. Yeah, I think Angela Merkel said 70%. So in a sense, it is reasonable to assume that a very large number of people will be infected. It is also true that once you have a lot of people affected, then the disease starts moving through the population more slowly. So this idea of herd immunity is true. The challenge is, of course, you've got to slow this down. You've got to bend the curve to try and flatten it so that health systems can cope. Now, Boris Johnson's argument was this is going to move through the population anyway. And so in a sense, it's sensible to let it move through because there's only so far you can mobilize. The challenge is if you look at China, I think of 80,000 people infected in China, that's 0.0005% of the Chinese population. And you saw the disruption that that caused. Mm. So looking to the long term, of course, if we are to go through 40, 50% of the global population and keep this tracking at a speed we can manage, it's looking to be quite a long game.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Let's, Ben, let's come back to Singapore. We're speaking with Dr. Ben Rolph, the CEO of the Communicable Disease Threat Initiative. What are the implications now for Singapore? Singapore is, even though we have additional cases coming on every day, the curve has flattened here greatly in the past 2 months. What are we expecting now that everyone else, you know, in Europe especially and North America is starting to, to really explode in terms of their numbers. And we're actually looking pretty good. We've got a pretty good handle on it, it would seem.
That's right. When the history of this is written, Singapore will be the exemplar of best practice. And I think the world will learn a huge amount from what Singapore has achieved. Mm. But, you know, they say no man is an island. Of course, Singapore is an extraordinarily well-connected island.
Yeah.
And we're already seeing a small uptick in cases. And you can see that some of these cases come from unknown sources or clusters. Mm. It is inevitable, and I think the government have been very clear and very professional in the way they've communicated this. It's inevitable there will be more cases as there are more cases amongst our neighbours. Again, Singapore has an outstanding ability to manage that because we have control over our borders and an extraordinary public health system. I think more important is the global reality that, of course, we have countries in Europe now scrambling to contain this, but we also have 3 or 4 billion people living in countries with no appreciable public health system. Mm. Nigeria has cases, India has cases, the Philippines, Indonesia, Bangladesh. Once a pandemic takes hold in those countries, of course, that is a humanitarian disaster for particularly the more elderly people in those populations, but it also has global implications.
Sure.
And the lesson, again, is that if you keep half of your global population living without access to basic healthcare, you cannot be surprised when it comes back to bite you. And sadly, that's where we are.
Yeah. Well, we certainly are not in a position to gloat or anything like that. But boy, myself and many of the people I talk to, everyone is quite happy to be right here in Singapore right now.
This is the place to be anywhere in the world. And this is what I tell anyone who's asking about traveling or where they might go for holidays, etc. I say, stay in Singapore. It is the safest and best place to be in this situation.
Great advice. Dr. Ben Rolph, the CEO of the Communicable Disease Threats Initiative. Thanks, Ben, for being with us this morning.
Thanks,
and Weekend Mornings.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.